Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, from the studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. Three ways to manage dread. Sometimes the problem lies in anticipating a bad thing that may never happen. Here's how to get a handle on this special kind of suffering by Beth Kurland, January 23rd, 2025. I was 35,000 feet in the air somewhere along the eastern coast of the United States, still an hour and a half from my destination, when the pilot came on and announced that there was severe weather ahead and that everyone needed to fasten their seatbelts immediately. For someone who doesn't like turbulence, loss of control, or uncertainty, this was a real fear-jerker for me. The tone in the captain's voice, the urgency of his message, and the hurried behavior of the flight attendants were huge cues of threat for my nervous system. What was fascinating to me was that my body was in full-blown anxiety mode, even though nothing was actually happening at that moment, not a bump or a disturbance of any kind. What was even more fascinating was that this reaction lasted a good part of the ride, even though it turned out that there was not one blip of turbulence. And in fact, that plane flight turned out to be one of the smoothest I've ever had. This example illustrates the way our minds anticipate emotional discomfort and experience anxiety and distress because of this. It illustrates what I would say is the difference between pain and suffering, a distinction made in Buddhist teachings. One way I think about this is that pain is what is actually here. Suffering, in this Buddhist context, is the narrative and mental constructing, the anticipating and projecting and resisting that our minds do. If I were in the middle of actual turbulence on a plane or in life, the experience would in and of itself be difficult. That is life's inevitable pain. But in my situation, there was no actual turbulence, just anticipation that created my suffering. Yet, how often do so many of us suffer due to dread of things that often never come to be? Or even if they do happen, we create additional suffering due to stories we attach to the experience before, during, or after its occurrence. One of the many benefits of mindfulness meditation is that it can help separate and differentiate sensations in the body from the narratives and the overlay of thoughts that our mind creates. In some interesting research on physical pain, mindfulness studies have found that meditators exposed to pain during experiments show an increase in activity in the parts of the brain that process the sensory experience of pain, but decreases in parts of the brain involved with thinking, evaluation, memory, and emotions associated with pain. With less subjective judgment about pain and less anticipation of pain, research participants reported less intensity and unpleasantness of the pain. This has been found to be true for emotional pain as well, with mindfulness training helpful in reducing anxiety and depression. How does any of this translate into finding more ease in our day-to-day lives? Here are a few things you can do to reduce the suffering that comes with the dread of uncertainty, whether you practice mindfulness meditation or not. Number one, begin to notice what is actually here and distinguish this from the anticipation and constructed stories about the future that our minds will often conjure up. Ask, what is actually here right now? In what way is my mind creating a story about something that is not actually happening right now, or only happening in my mind? Sometimes, getting out a piece of paper and making two columns can be helpful to really differentiate these. For example, in the column for what is actually here, you might write, I'm getting ready to give a presentation. I'm feeling nervous. For the second column, what your mind is imagining, you might write, I'm going to make a fool of myself. People will think badly of me and I'll feel humiliated. I'm not good enough. Now, step back and view both columns from a little bit of distance. Appreciate the distinction between your lived experience, based on facts, and the mental constructs that accompany that lived experience, based on interpretation or anticipation. That little bit of mindful distance can be the difference between being caught in the middle of a storm versus watching the storm pass by from a sheltered spot. The storm is there nonetheless, but with awareness and clear seeing, the storm can become just a little bit more tolerable. 2. Be with what is here. If difficulty is here in the moment, we have some choices. We might take skillful actions if anything can be done to lessen our pain. For example, call a friend for comfort or do something helpful to calm or soothe ourselves. On the plane, rhythmic breathing was something I could direct my attention to, and it helped to anchor my nervous system and steady my mind in the midst of my fear. When possible, we can problem solve the situation if the situation allows. For example, seek out skilled doctors if there is a medical problem or illness. Practice a presentation beforehand to gain more confidence. Both problem solving and skillful actions are effective for things that are within our sphere of influence. But often, with difficult situations, there is at least some aspect of it that falls outside our sphere of influence. This is where acceptance can be most helpful. Bringing acceptance to that which we can't control might look like making space to be with our sadness or grief about a loss or upsetting event, or reminding ourselves that we can put in our best effort but can't always control the outcome of a situation. Accepting doesn't mean we like what is happening or that we're okay with it. It means that we take the resistance and emotional struggle out of fighting something that we can't change. Doing so can free up our energy to acknowledge our fears and bring compassion to our emotional struggles. 3. If your mind is conjuring up difficulty that is not actually here, notice this tendency of the mind and make note of the ways it is creating unnecessary suffering for you. Let's go back to the person about to do a presentation. They might notice that while some anxiety before a presentation is normal and common, their anticipation of messing up and people thinking badly of them and judging themselves as not enough is making an already challenging situation more difficult. In this noticing, they might remind themselves to come back to what is actually here. There is anxiety in my body, yes. And then there is the narrative my mind is constructing. The anxiety becomes more workable when it is separated from all of the mental constructs attached to it, and when it can be accepted for what it is. On the plane, it was helpful for me to observe that my body was reacting to an anticipated situation, fear of turbulence, and not to a present moment one. In my case, this didn't stop the anxiety from being there, but it did help me to see a little more clearly what was happening and do so with some curiosity and kindness. From this place, I did the best that I could to soothe myself. I put on meditation music and focused on my breathing, and I tried to surrender control over what was to happen, since I had none. Eventually, I was able to recalibrate to what was actually here, the smooth air, people going about their business around me, and me as a passenger who is anxious about turbulence. We can distinguish what is actually here from the narratives our mind conjures up. We may still experience anxiety, dread, or other unpleasant emotions that are a natural part of our human condition, but we can loosen the grip, lessen the impact, and step into the observing nature of our mind and of awareness itself that can often bring some ease to even the most challenging moments. About the author. Beth Kurland, PhD, is a psychologist, public speaker, and author of 4 books, including You Don't Have to Change Everything, 6 Ways to Shift Your Vantage Point, Stop Striving for Happy, and Find True Well-Being, and Dancing on the Tightrope, Transcending the Habits of Your Mind and Awakening to Your Fullest Life. Beth has been in clinical practice since 1994 and provides evidence-based treatment to people across the lifespan with a focus on using mindfulness and mind-body strategies. To enjoy free meditations and other resources, you can visit Beth Kurland, BethKurland.com. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. Even 1-year-olds try to help others. A new study finds that the desire to be kind to those in need begins much younger than we think. By Jill Suddy, January 21st, 2025. We all have the capacity for caring about others and helping them out. But how early do we develop kindness? According to results from a new study, it may begin very early in life, even earlier than other research has suggested. How babies try to help. In this study, researcher Rose Donahoe of Washington University, St. Louis, and her colleagues studied the behavior of a group of diverse 11 to 20-month-old babies. More than half were black and low income, to see how they would respond to someone needing help. After some initial testing to measure their cognitive and motor skills, babies were placed in a high chair facing a researcher who demonstrated two tasks: putting multiple balls into a box or stacking blocks. The researcher first showed how the task is done in a playful way. Then she mimicked being unable to reach the piece she needed to finish the task, signaling a desire for assistance. The baby could help by either putting the ball or block into the researcher's hand or finishing the task for her by putting the ball in the box or placing the block on the pile. If the baby didn't help after 20 seconds passed, the researcher indicated she needed assistance in a more obvious way, like saying, "the ball," or "I can't reach." A research assistant kept track of whether babies assisted in one of the two ways, and if so, how much time passed before they stepped up to help. Approximations of helping, such as the baby approaching the researcher's hand or the ball bin, were also noted. Through a series of analyses, Donahoe and her colleagues looked at how frequently babies helped, what kinds of help they gave, and whether helping was affected by the age or sex of the baby. What they found was amazing. Over 80% of the youngest babies in the group, no more than 12 months old, offered to help the researchers by retrieving out-of-reach items and either handing them over or completing the task. This was true no matter the baby's gender or cognitive and motor skills, and almost all helping occurred without any prompting within the first 20 seconds of the task. This surprised Donahoe. "We were thinking the rates might be low and that a helping approximation might be meaningful in this young age group," she says. "But the kids fully helped so much that we thought, fully helped so much more than we thought that they would, and at a much higher rate than we expected." Kinds of helping. Over several rounds, the babies were about evenly split between those who handed the ball or block to the researchers and those who finished the task for them, and they tended to keep to the same strategy across rounds. Donahoe says this means that babies are already developing preferred ways to help, something that may continue into later life. This really speaks to the possibility that kids' helping behaviors are not only more frequent at a younger age, but more sophisticated and developed than we adults would initially guess, she says. Her research team also found that baby girls had a slight preference for handing the ball to the researcher, while baby boys had a preference for completing the task themselves. Donahoe doesn't know why that would be, but speculates socialization plays a role. Girls may be encouraged to pay more attention to the person in an interaction, while boys may be encouraged to demonstrate self-efficacy more. People think of socialization factors coming into play later on, but we know that those are starting right from the get-go, she says. Babies are watching everything parents are doing, soaking up everything like a sponge. Interestingly, the percentage of kids helping did not increase much between younger and older babies, though there was a slight tick upward. However, older babies were more likely to help on all of their rounds and help by completing the tasks themselves. This may be due to older babies becoming more comfortable and confident in their abilities as they age, says Donahoe. Kinder babies, kinder society? Her study informs future research on moral development as babies appear to demonstrate pro-social leanings very young in life. The key to uncovering this tendency, though, Donahoe says, is offering a helping challenge that's within a baby's developmental capabilities and working with larger, more diverse groups of babies. Giving children this age a chance to show what they can do by recruiting a large sample of them and designing the tasks to give them the most opportunities to be kind can pull out their greatest abilities, she says. Her work has implications for parents, she adds. If we want our kids to learn how to be kind and helpful towards others, the building blocks are already there within them. That's a tendency that can be nurtured. To raise kind kids, Donahoe suggests that parents model kind behavior themselves, giving their babies opportunities to learn through observation. While it's unclear from her study if positive reinforcement would help or hinder kindness, the researcher in her experiment was not trained to smile at or praise the babies in any way. She believes parental encouragement could make a positive difference in raising helpful children. Young kids have much more advanced and innate abilities to learn pro-social behaviors and kindness and empathy than scientists ever thought, she said. If you're a parent, you should feel free to encourage these behaviors in them. They are wired for it, and parents can build upon them. And we just have time for a greater good in action practice. This one is entitled Mindful Breathing, a way to build resilience to stress, anxiety, and anger. How to do it. Time required. 5 minutes daily for at least a week, though evidence suggests that mindfulness increases the more you practice it. Number one, find a relaxed, comfortable position. You could be seated on a chair or on the floor on a cushion. Try to keep your back upright, but not too tight. Hands resting wherever they're comfortable. Tongue on the roof of your mouth or wherever it's comfortable. Two, notice and invite your body to relax. Let yourself relax and become curious about your body seated here, the sensations it experiences, the touch, the connection with the floor or the chair. Do your best to relax any areas of tightness or tension. Breathe. Three, tune into the rhythm of your breath. You can feel the natural flow of breath in and out. You don't need to do anything to your breath, not long, not short, but natural. Notice where you feel your breath in your body. It might be in your abdomen, It may be in your chest or throat or in your nostrils. See if you can feel the sensations of breath, one breath at a time. When one breath ends, the next breath begins. If you are not able to notice the breath in all areas of the body, that's okay. We are more connected to certain areas of the body than others at different times of the day. 4. Now, as you do this, you might notice that your mind may start to wander. You may start thinking about other things. If this happens, it is not a problem. It's very natural. Try to notice that your mind has wandered. You can say thinking or wandering in your head softly, and then gently redirect your attention right back to the breathing. 5. Stay here for 5 to 7 minutes. Notice your breath in silence. From time to time, you'll get lost in thought and then return to your breath. 6. After a few minutes, once again notice your body, your whole body, seated here. Let yourself relax even more deeply, and then, if it is available, please offer yourself some appreciation for doing this practice today. Why you should try it. Stress, anger, and anxiety can impair not only our health, but our judgment and skills of attention. One way to help deal with these difficult feelings is the practice of mindfulness, the ability to pay careful attention to what you're thinking, feeling, and sensing in the present moment without judging those thoughts and feelings as good or bad. Countless studies link mindfulness to better health, lower anxiety, and greater resilience to stress. You have been listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix. Thank you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.